It's weird calling you Adam just because my name's Aaron West, and so I've spent my entire life being called Adam because of Batman. So actually, when I typed earlier, I almost typed my own name because, yeah, I just used to seeing that. So
I get it too. That's funny. I would get that too, Adam West. So, you know, some people feel the compulsion to make a joke like that, but then are wise enough to suppress that urge.
Right.
But don't. So they'll say, "Where's Eve?" That's another one I used to get a lot. I'll get it very rarely. And boy, did they love it when you respond to it. Like, she's in the car. You know? They love it. They just love it. So if somebody actually says Aaron West or Adam West to you, you should just, return this, just swing the ball right back.
Well, what's usually for me, it's accidental. Like we'll be having a conversation and they'll call me Aaron and then we'll hang up or say goodbye and they'll, thanks, Adam.
Yes.
And you can tell that they were thinking about the joke and it was on the tip of the tongue and then they just couldn't help. So,
No, I understand. But I get that too, but it's not usually with another A name. It's with like David or something. In fact, Dawn Hudson, who is, I'm going to botch her title at the Academy. She used to run the Los Angeles Film Festival, and then she moved up to the Oscars.
I know the name.
She's the president of the. I'm going to screw it up, so I don't want to say it. But she is one of the senior executives at the Academy Awards. I had a phone interview with her once. This goes back at least 5 years ago. Before she was at the Oscars, she was still at the Los Angeles Film Festival, and she gets a lovely person, just so down. She's Southerner, and she probably from Nashville or something like that. And she gets off the phone and she said goodbye some other name. I didn't even really catch it, but she called me back, and I wasn't at my desk, so I missed the call. And there's this lovely message from her saying, I realized I call you by some other name. And
That's nice.
She called me back just to apologize.
That's nice. By the way, I turned video off because I was getting a notice about a network connection. So it might be on my end. And I'll probably edit that out. Oh, I should mention that at some point I have like the weakest bladder in the world and it's famously weakest bladder. So at some point I'll have to take a break.
Only to your Patreon listeners.
Exactly. So you've seen this. Yeah. So there'll be a little bonus content there.
Do you actually take the recording, all your equipment to the bathroom? Because that's your price of admission right there.
I don't think anybody wants that. What I should do is I should just pour water next to the microphone. Maybe get like one of those like a cat. What do they call those? The little cat dispensers that are the little water river.
Yeah, but Aaron, that's what gets that's the power suggestion that makes people want to pee. So
exactly. Well, no, I want people to pee with me. It's like we want people to watch the movies with us that we're talking about, so they get more out of the show. We want people to pee with us, get more out of the pee breaks. All right. Well, and that's enough about pee. I'm sure it'll come back up. But this is Criterion Now 48. I'm Aaron West, and I'm here with Adam Shartoff. Am I pronouncing that right?
Perfectly.
Okay. Great. So we're going to talk. Adam is from FilmWax Radio, so really one of the pioneers of film podcasting. So it's an honor to have you here. We're going to talk about a number of things: Silence of the Lambs, just a bunch of Criterion stuff like we usually do. Filmstruck. Do you subscribe to Filmstruck? I know we're going to get into that.
It's funny. I was, and I'm just. It's not that I'm a cheapskate. I guess I am a cheapskate.
You can be a cheapskate.
It's not that. It's a very reasonable price, but I get it. So I'm going to sound like a jerk, but I am a jerk. So therefore it's okay. But I get all these, I had on one of the programmers from Filmstruck on episode last year. And I'm always holding out for that gratis subscription.
Yeah.
So I have like Fandor and Mubi and a few of the other smaller streaming services. I try to, promote and help to put them on people's radar, and then they give me a free subscription. So I'll probably just break down and just get it because, I've had to borrow a couple of logins, and that's no good.
Well, first off, being a jerk is a prerequisite for being on this show, so you're in good company. and I'm actually the same way. I actually had Alicia Malone she kind of is the hostess of Filmstruck last year, and in fact, she started her own Filmstruck podcast. But I haven't probably haven't gotten around to asking. They probably would say yes, I guess. They did send me some swag.
If anybody deserves it, you do. Jeez.
What's that?
I said if anybody deserves a complimentary subscription to Filmstruck, it's you.
Okay, well, let's tell Filmstruck that. I have the monthly subscription, but the good thing is, even though we're going to talk about Filmstruck, you don't actually have to have it to talk about it. So, in fact, mine was inactive for a couple months because I subscribed during the beta when they came out, it was last year, so it just expired. So, but it's we use that as conversation starters. So anyway, Adam Shartoff, FilmWax Radio, and you just recently had a successful Kickstarter campaign. So do you want to just tell us about you and the show and maybe give us a little history? What makes Adam tick?
Well, I had a little film series in Brooklyn going back a bunch of years now. And from that was like I started doing a show, but I don't call it a podcast because I was introduced to these people in Brooklyn who were just starting an internet radio platform called Bebox Radio. It's still around. They have it's a great, great operation. But most of the shows are music shows, but they had a few talk shows and they said, why don't you, meaning me, do a show about your film series and invite on local filmmakers and people like that. And I said, oh, okay. I didn't have any background in it. And this is in 2011, I guess, early 2011.
That's a long time ago.
Yeah, it is now, right? And so sometime over that summer, they started it up and I started a film series, but very quickly they just morphed into me interviewing, realizing why am I just trying to do people and promote this film series, which ended up kind of, ending really, after a while. So I continued with the internet radio show. So if you go back to the earliest episodes, you'll see there's just tons of these half hour segments.
Okay.
And I was doing that for a while. And then I started podcasting them. And then I realized, why am I doing internet radio? I could just pop. that became a real sort of popular, thing after a while. Everybody was starting to podcast. So I said, why am I doing the internet radio part of it? I've been doing that since then, and I just have expanded on the idea and bring on all sorts of people from the industry, not just filmmakers, but anybody from an editor. Like I had the editor of iTanya on recently, who's nominated for an Oscar, and I've had on many people that work in distribution and programming at festivals and writers and actors, of course. And, it's been an incredible education for myself and hopefully for regular listeners are learning a lot as well. So,
yeah, it's a great show. And I think of you and maybe like Film Spotting as one of the film podcast pioneers, and I love how you use the radio term. And there's a radio exists, and there's satellite radio, and what do they call it? Terrestrial radio,
right?
However, it's kind of dwindling in popularity. But I think the term radio has been co-opted because really, internet radio is kind of an oxymoron. It's not really truly radio. I guess if it's live, it could be. But
well, like a lot of new technologies, they lean on the old technologies because there's an existing nomenclature, so and something people can wrap their minds around, so they use that. And I named it when it was on Bebox, and it was internet, what they called internet radio.
Right.
So when I went podcasting, I just felt I could have kept it. In fact, the people at Bebox at one point were kind of upset that they asked me to change the name of it from FilmWax Radio to FilmWax.
Huh.
But I stuck with it because I just liked the old-timey sound,
I love it. It's a great name.
Thank you.
You're FilmWax Radio. Yeah, you can't change your stripes midstream. You can't remove them. I saw, actually, you just had Hal Hartley on, and contributed to his campaign for the Henry Fool trilogy, and I actually just got it this week, so I can't wait to rewatch some of that. It's one of my favorite, my wife's favorite trilogies, so she was really excited about it. I haven't seen the other two films.
Oh, great. So you'll really enjoy that experience.
So yeah, I recommend people check out Adam's show. You have 400 something episodes, lots of content and lots of talent. So yeah, it's great to have you here.
Can I just add that for people to find it, obviously it's on iTunes and Stitcher and that type of thing. But it's mm-hmm. When I left that internet radio company, Bebox, I switched. I needed a website to create the feed on, and I just thought, well, rather than just do my own website, why don't I just see if there's any independent film organization that will be okay. So I emailed Rooftop Films, which is a very popular New York, Brooklyn, New York kind of film annual summer long film festival, outdoor film festival, and I reached out to Filmmaker Magazine, the people there.
Oh, cool.
And Rooftop embraced it immediately, so the show still remains on that website as well as my own website. And then I started putting segments up on YouTube as well. Like I was putting up the episodes on YouTube. I'd strip out like my stolen music and stuff. Yeah. I would put, and then I realized recently, why don't I just put up the isolate each, you know, segment and put those up instead. So people could just listen to whatever they want to, you know? So
yeah. A good friend of mine put all their back catalog up on YouTube, and I thought about that, but I don't know. It seems like a lot of work for
it is, but I'm, you know, like on some episode, like the last one you mentioned, Hal Hartley was the sole guest, you know, but right. Then on another episode, I might have three segments or something, or two segments. So YouTube gave me the opportunity just to take a segment and put them up individually. Now
that's a good idea. Good idea.
Yeah.
Well, if you don't mind, let me just give some Patreon shout-outs. We have some people that have been very generous with our campaign, and I know you've experienced this with your Kickstarter. I'm just doing five at a time, and at some point I'll run out, but so far the campaign's going very well at the very beginning. So just want to throw out a few names here. William Remmers, who was on the show once, and he's actually in your neighborhood. He's a huge opera, basically the opera king in New York. Well, okay, maybe not the opera king, but to me, he's the opera king. But
king of all.
Yeah, in our community, he's the opera king. And then we have Joshua Wilson, who we also is part of our community. I know he's a big singer. I know he does the chorus, that sort of thing. He also loves Barry Lyndon. That's kind of an in joke because I made fun of somebody posting their Barry Lyndon sale haul from Criterion, and it turned out he actually did that very thing. And so now every time I ask about somebody's haul, he posts that one image of Barry Lyndon. Then we have Matt, I think it's Keo, or it's K-E-O-U-G-H.
Yeah, Keo. Yeah,
Keo. I have a good friend that's
that same last name.
Oh, do you? Okay. I have a friend that has his name is Huff, but it's spelled similarly, and he mm-hmm. pronounces the GH as an F. But I don't know Matt. So Matt, come say hello to you to us somehow. Join the community or tweet us. But thank you for contributing. And then we have Ryan Kuiper, who's also in the Now group, and he contributes a little bit. And thank you, Ryan. And then we have Shelley Sampin, who is one of the coolest people in the Now group. She's actually been just a few months, but she's been a fixture there. So not to say the other people are not cool, but...
No, she's an especially cool person.
Yes, and also she's the only female on this list so far. In fact, I think she's...
Wow.
I mean, we do skew male, our audience. I think I looked at the Facebook group, and it was like 94% male, so... Yeah.
Well, after my episode, you don't be surprised if all of a sudden it changes.
Oh, all the ladies are gonna join.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Great. Well,
yeah.
we are gonna talk about a very I think female empowering film. So, well,
right.
you want to get into some Criterion stuff?
Yeah.
All right, so first, I know you talk about all sorts of film on your podcast, indie film. I think a little bit of popular film, but I know you have a good relationship with Criterion. Do you want to just give a little bit about your background of Criterion? We used to do this on our old show, our Criterion Connection.
I'm trying to I do. Yes. The answer is yes, I do. And I know a few. You know what it was? When I was doing a film series, which I referenced before, there was one point where I started realizing another nice component was to start to host like DVD release parties. So this goes back obviously a while now.
Yeah.
but it was the Lena Dunham's Tiny Furniture. Do you remember that
movie? Of course, yeah. Oh, it gets talked about a lot in our community. Oh. Sometimes not too favorably. But
silly question. Do you remember that movie that broke Lena Dunham into the popular stream? Anyway, so that went on to Criterion. But this is even before Girls.
Yeah, yeah.
This is rare. I mean, I contacted Criterion, and I think I knew somebody who worked there already. Yeah, I did. But I never had been there. I never really had any business-related matter before this. But I contacted them. I said, you know, it's about to come out. I'd love to do a party. And, you know, and at the time, the idea of inviting Lena, who I already met and interviewed for another outlet, I thought this was completely doable. But as it turns out, there was a micro cinema who also offered to do something. So we ended up doing it together. And basically, to get to the long short of it, is that I that was my introduction to the folks there. And I dealt with the producer of that package. And then over time, I recently did a I know people that have worked there now, you know, just through work. Film industry over years, and then most recently I did a panel I hosted about film restoration, and I invited one of the guys from Janus, and then there have been some screenings, like they'll have press screenings up at their office in their little theater. So, and then I was finally, of course, like I think you were invited into the closet, and that of course is
I've been to the old closet, but not the new closet. Oh. They have a new one, so
I didn't realize that.
Yep, and you may have as well, but it's just an office, basically. Well, maybe a little more than an office, but So are you a big classic film fan?
Yeah. Yeah. Are you talking about Criterion classics specifically, or are you just talking about classic films?
Especially, well, I guess we're going to get into a lot of classic films, so I guess the answer to that question is going to come out either way.
Yeah. You know, again, when I was a kid in New York City, there were just so many... you know, there were so many movie houses playing, classics anyway. So
a lot of them are still there.
What?
A lot of them are still there. I couldn't believe that Lincoln Center is going to close.
Oh, no. That's the Lincoln Plaza. That closed. The Lincoln Plaza Cinema is an art house that's across the street from Lincoln Center, essentially, independent of Lincoln Center. The Walter Reed, which is, you know, the theaters that are part of Lincoln Center are still operating.
Oh, good. I was scared when I...
it was the Lincoln Plaza, which was this, I think, three cinemas. I may be wrong. It might be a twin, but I should have known. But anyway, say they're going to put a new cinema in there. And if it's going to cater to that neighborhood, the Upper West Side, I wouldn't be surprised if it were another repertory. It's not that repertory has disappeared altogether, but there just used to be so many, you know, places. So I grew up with a love of old movies as a teenager. I used to come into Manhattan. I grew up in Queens. Mm. I would come into Manhattan on my own and just go to see like a double feature, like every opportunity I got. Yeah,
that is awesome. Well, when I go to New York, we always try to find a film because usually there's some restoration or some special screening playing somewhere, you know, between Walter Reed, the Quad, Film Forum, and now the Metrograph, and there's a lot, and actually Brooklyn has, I guess it's the Draft House. I guess is that the biggest Brooklyn?
Yeah, and then right down the block from Draft House is BAM, and they still do special stuff like that. You might be able to see something through there. But you're right. It's like a
treasure of riches. I can only imagine living there. And I don't know how often you go into the city now to watch movies, but I envy you, your access because we do okay here. We have an indie theater that I'm going to get to see Persona next week or next month. So that's something special.
Oh, it is. And it's hard to compare. You know, I mean, it's not fair because New York City is just such an exception. You know, it's like, it's one of three or four cities in the world that have had, you know, so much cinema. But, you know, the only other thing I'll say about it, growing up in the 70s, because I'm a little older than you guys, but you go to see Hardcore, you know, we were talking about Paul Schrader before.
Right.
or you go to see Taxi Driver, again, Paul Schrader connection. But, and, you know, you'd see him in Times Square where these things were shot and it would still kind of be seedy and... that's the New York City I grew up in, you know. Yeah. So it has holds a little romance now, but at the time, nah, maybe not so much. You know?
Yeah, I do enjoy seeing that that New York in film, and you just talked about Midnight Cowboy. It was there as well. So, was that New York or San Diego? What? Oh, I'm sorry, Hardcore was San Diego. I'm mixing up my.
No, I say Hardcore, but he that's right. He did not go to New York City, right? In that film, he was all done in Southern California.
I think it was Grand Rapids in Southern California, but anyway, yeah. I digress. So, well, we're in towards the end of February, and we had a pretty big month. Just released was Satyajit Ray's The Hero and Connie Chikawa's An Actor's Revenge. And then this week we have Tom Jones, Tony Richardson coming out. And then we have a little break in March. And then we have, speaking of which, we have Scorsese's The Age of Innocence. New York director, but not a very New York movie. So I'm actually going to save The Hero for my short take. But do you have any thoughts on the February and early March release slate? Or
Let's see.
I know you've seen Tom Jones, right?
That's right. I do. I did get a copy of that. And I just started really dipping into it, but I watched the entire film straight, as I will do. And then usually I go into it. There's an audio commentary. I'll go into that. But they have two versions on this. They have the theatrical version and the director's cut. And the director's cut in this case is shorter.
Yeah, and kind of like a Chinese bookie. That happens a lot. And I think Cassavetes preferred Chinese bookie's shorter version to the longer version. So it's that's the way. Actually, we talked about PTA a couple weeks ago, and he had a Reddit, and somebody asked him, what would you do differently if you were making Magnolia? And he said, I'd cut 20 minutes. So
wow.
I love that that self-awareness. It seems like I don't want to get into a get-off-my-lawn Hollywood conversation, but it seems like mainstream Hollywood films are getting longer and longer, whereas art house independent films are getting shorter. So anyway,
well, there's more to it than just aesthetics in those cases. I just want to, I don't want to, you know, get off topic, but like with the festivals, and pressure of festivals, they all want like 80 minute films.
Yeah.
So the independent film, when they're going into the whole, that, you know, the festivals is a very important marketing and component for them. And part of their trajectory of a successful film, it can often make or break a film, not just getting into Sundance, but any kind of press, et cetera. So they will often try to accommodate that, you know, 80 to 90 minute schedule. So that's part of the story.
Yeah, and, you know, Cannes is sometimes the opposite, because often they'll preview a film at Cannes that's the director's cut that's really long. Bellatar, I think, is an example of that. Mm-hmm. And then it'll be well received and they won't cut it. Or what's the gentleman that did Loveless this year? He did the Russian. I would butcher his name even if I had it in front of me. But when he did the movie about religion, that was so good, a Leviathan a couple years ago.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Great movie, long movie, could have been cut down, but it was successful at Cannes, so just why not leave it as is. Well, anyway, we do get into a little bit of Criterion news, which I think will be good discussion topics for you. But there's a possible Abbas Kiarostami box set coming. And Adam, this is a little funny in our community that we just get news from people that go to festivals and hear stuff. But that's exactly what this is. Somebody was at a festival, and Kiarostami's son, Ahmad Kiarostami, was at giving a talk, I guess probably a talk back after a screening. And he said that Criterion is working on a box set with all of his films, quote, all of his films, to be released in 2019. The only difference is the Coker trilogy is going to be released separately as its own set. So there's already a few already out. And in fact, I think there was one, 24 Frames is coming out on Janus
right
soon. So are you a Kiarostami aficionado?
I've seen most of his films, so I guess that would make me in the scheme of things an aficionado. But I mean, I'm not like my friend Godfrey Cheshire, who's, you know, knew Abbas very well, who knows his son very well, and very close to the whole Kiarostami family. He's a critic based here in New York, although he's a Southern boy himself.
Yeehaw!
What's that?
I said yeehaw.
And he's got, in fact, he's got a book coming out about Iranian cinema. Okay. So he's somebody you may want to get on. In case you do an episode, I'll introduce you to him because he'd be a great guest for a deep dive into Kiar Starmer and Iranian cinema in general.
You know, from what I've seen, I love Iranian cinema. I love Jafar Pahlavi's early stuff, which is it's very gritty and neo-realist style. I think Kiar Starmer, I think, has that element, but he's more experimental and likes to play around. But he does like to play around with documentary forms.
Right.
And bring that into his I guess art, his aesthetic.
But I'm on the same page as you, Aaron. I love the Pahlavi. Is probably somebody who I related more to as a movie lover, just going to see his films.
Yeah, I think story wise, I just really like how he just the stories he tells. But Kiar Starmer, I love A Taste of Cherry, and I love Close Up is terrific. I love a lot of his films, and. And then let's see. I'm already off track. The next thing is Barnes & Noble is dying. So
I was depressed. I read that article you sent me.
Yeah, it is depressing. And so, long story.
I worked at Barnes & Noble, and it was like my first job was at Barnes & Noble.
So what's funny is I worked there too, I worked there in between jobs. long story, but I had a career and I sold a company and then I had a little acquisition money. So I was able to take a little time off and I worked at Barnes & Noble just because I wanted to. I did not work at Barnes & Noble for the $7.75 per hour. And I loved it because you're just around people that love books and just really interesting, cultured, really characters. And probably a lot of the people I worked with got fired last couple weeks. I don't know how long it's been for you.
Many years.
It's been many years for me too. In fairness, I probably would have gotten a raise from my $7.75 by now. Maybe it'd be $9. I don't know. But for Criterion fans, that's a sore point because Barnes & Noble gives us a big Criterion sale, and they're one of the few retailers that actually has a good library dedicated to Criterion and just art film in general, even though they're not really competitive with the big box retailers online. I say big box. they're big shipping boxes. So, what are your feelings about this?
Yeah, no, I'm sad. I'm also as a parent who definitely took their kid to Barnes & Noble many occasions because it was just they always had a great kids, books department, kid book department as well. And they would always have like interactive things going on, whether it be readings or puppet shows, that kind of thing. And I know that a lot of parents really lean on Barnes & Noble for that. There are not a lot of indoor spots that do that kind of thing, especially for free. And then there is that nostalgic connection. I did work at before it even became a big chain store, I worked at the flagship store in New York. And
oh, wow.
I have a little bit of a history with it. Going back to, I'm talking about, I don't know how old you are, but it goes back to like the 80s.
Okay, so, well, that.
So I was pretty young.
That's pretty early in their history too, yeah.
So the article I read it didn't say that it was all about full-time employees though. And though while it's sort of,
yeah, we're not saying
it seems like it is definitely a sign that they're in more than just a little bit of trouble, but they're online. I assume their online, presence is not necessarily threatened, of course. So
yeah, I think they'll survive. The actual headline is Barnes and Noble is killing itself, and I think that was the slant of the article, just saying that they're killing their retail operations. And I don't know if that they're doing that deliberately. And by retail, I mean their brick and mortar, which of course, well, a lot of people would argue that they put out the bookstores out of business, but these vast stores with huge inventory and high shelves, and it's just a lot to keep up with. If you're not selling, but their website actually, even though it's not as competitive as Amazon, it's functional. I won't praise it. I think they've made some bad decisions. I don't think they've innovated really since the early 2000s, and I think the Nook was just trying to follow the Kindle.
Right. Yeah, they're not innovators. They were in the publishing world, but yeah. You know, and certainly in as a bookseller. And you know, I think you know there was a boom in the 1990s, real estate wise, and there was a lot of money. And in New York, like especially, I know, and pretty much around the country, they just opened tons of these you know superstores, mm-hmm. which. You know, were a place where you could go, spend hours sitting in chairs, and you know they just wanted people in there, and it did drive up the rents, like you know for stores all of a sudden shot up like astronomically.
Absolutely, yeah.
While you know the closing of Barnes and Noble superstores, there's only a couple really left. You mm-hmm. know, there's not that many. There were quite a few back in the 90s into the 2000s. But the problem now is while on one hand you'd think, oh, there's an opportunity for used bookstores and smaller, you know, more curated bookstores to come in, but it's really not because they can't afford to open a yeah. store in most neighborhoods of Manhattan or what have you.
Well, they have the big one at Union Square, which is
right.
I don't see that one going away just because there's so much foot traffic now. I'm sure the rent's not exactly cheap on that block, but.
Yeah,
it is sad.
They did have an enormous Criterion.
They do
inventory there. Yeah,
yeah. I just love walking in there. And to your point about the child section, I have some siblings that are much younger, and so I have fond memories of getting my little brother. He's graduated college now, but my younger brother, I got him a Harry Potter book when it came out at midnight. I went there, and that was like, he still remembers that as one of his most special life moments. I'm like, just because I went to a store at midnight. And then I got Diary of a Teenager?
Diary of a Wimpy Kid, which...
It was Meg Cabot was the name. So anyway, whatever series she wrote, I got one of those from my sister. And so those, yeah, and in their children's section, they have story time. It would be a big loss, I think, just culturally.
Yeah.
Of course, yeah. But the small bookstores that they put out of business probably are not sad. So anyway, let's move on to more positive news, which is, here's a guy that many people – including myself, have not heard of until this past week. Niko Papatakis. I think that's a Greek-sounding name. I don't know much about him.
That's a Greek name.
Yeah. But I think I looked up his background, and it wasn't distinctly Greek, but I'm positive there's Greek origins there. So Jonathan Rosenbaum confirmed that Criterion's going to release a box set of his films. There are five films. And they're going to play Film Society Lincoln Center. Speaking of which, thank God it's not closed. But these films are very, very small, and I had never heard of any of them. They, if you just look online at the different review sites, Letterboxd, IMDb, not many reviews or even people watched them. So I kind of wonder if this might be like an eclipse set. However, they're all new restorations, so it sounds like it might be an actual box set. And sometimes Criterion will have these discoveries of lesser known directors, which I really like. You know, they can put out Silence of the Lambs and get this, you know, Mr. Papatakis that nobody's ever heard of. So, Adam, you're very well, very seasoned. Was he new to you, or?
Yeah, he is new to me. You know, I'm relatively well versed. You know, with filmmakers around the world, but I mean, if you compare me to the average person or even average movie person, self-identified movie person, but you know, I mean, really, the truth is my area of their expertise is still the American film. You know, I mean, we're American. So I mean, I love also like French. There are pockets of areas around that I'm also a big fan of, but you know, Greek films is not up there at the top. So this is an introduction to me.
Okay. Well, what was the Greek, the female Greek filmmaker that made that? This is great podcasting. I don't know a lot of Grecian cinema, but I think Greek culture is fantastic, fascinating.
Yeah, and as a also as a screen, like sometimes as a film festival screener where I'm on a screening committee, mm-hmm. I remember just getting a batch of film, like contemporary, you know, Greek films from various filmmakers. I don't know why all of a sudden there was just this batch, maybe because some Greek film institute, mm-hmm. you know, collectively made this submission, you know, to this festival, and I got to review them, and every single one of them was better than the next.
Yeah.
Seriously.
Yeah.
Like, I'm like, oh, I need to know more about Greek, contemporary Greek cinema, you know.
And I would love to learn more. And again, I don't know if Nico's, if he lives in Greece. The person I'm thinking of is Sangari.
Athena.
I forget the name of the. She was in the Woody Allen, not Woody Allen. She was in the Midnight, Before Midnight, and helped produce that.
She Greek... did Attenberg and Chevalier, right?
Chevalier was the one I was thinking of. Yeah, okay. That's the most recent. Yeah, she's done a few, and I actually she has some ties to Criterion, so maybe one day her stuff will come out. But yeah, so for what it's worth, there might be some Papatakis movies. Is that right? So now on to Germany. Wim Wenders.
As they say.
Do you like Wim Wenders? He's he's German, of course, but he's worked here doing, of course, Paris, Texas is the most monumental. So are you a fan?
Oh, yeah. I mean, again, as a young man in 1987, seeing Wings of Desire changed. Yeah. I think I'd already seen Paris, Texas, but when I saw Wings of Desire, which I went back to 3 or 4 times, I mean, that really was one of the seminal films of my youth that made me into the film lover I became. Absolutely. Wim Wenders is right there at the top, you know.
Yeah, Wenders is a favorite of mine as well, and I've actually seen half of Wings of Desire in the cinema because the print broke and they couldn't fix it. So the half I saw was just magical, and I think it's a film that just works very well in at home and in theaters. But just I guess the camera movement and how fluid it is, it's kind of a journey in a way. So I did love it, but would have loved to have seen the end. So anyway, there are a lot of Wenders films on Criterion, and we know that they have the rights because Janis toured pretty much everything in his filmography a few months ago. And a UK label put out is coming out with a bunch of his films, and one of them that are coming out is one of the films that is coming out in April is The Goalie's Anxiety at the Penalty Kick, which is one of his earlier films, and this is the label is AX1. I think they're also doing, I think that they did Wings of Desire. I could be wrong. Mm-hmm. And a few others are coming out. So this and Until the End of the World, I think, are the two notable films that haven't come to Criterion. But, of course, we had The American Friend. We had The Road Trilogy. We had Buena Vista Social Club. Have you seen this or have you seen The End of the World?
Yeah, well, I saw like the End of the World. I saw that one when it came out. Like, you know, after Wings of Desire, I just thought, oh, I'm going to try to. It's like taking ecstasy or something. You
right.
just keep the experience, and it never quite. From what I hear, anecdotally, of course.
How about ecstasy while watching Wings of Desire?
I think I must have because I was definitely in some sort of other, you know, euphoric state of mind watching it. And then Peter Falk, I mean, you know, just put him in anything.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, he's great.
Nothing, I don't think he ever made another film quite as good. But you know, I'm a fan also of his documentaries, which are those also on Filmstruck?
Well,
like Pina and all that?
Pina is, and in fact, that's the only 3D title on Filmstruck, and nobody has a 3D TV anymore, including myself, so I guess
right.
that we're missing out. Salt of the Earth was a big one a couple years ago, but that's not on Criterion. But I think that is coming out from the this label, and yeah, so I'm just looking now. They have The American Friend, Kings of the Road, Alice in the Cities, Paris, Texas, so greatest.
Well, there's the Road Trilogy, which, you know, I watched a few months back, like right in a row, which is incredible. I mean, I think Alice in the Cities is just one of my favorite, another favorite, you know. But it's part of this trilogy, and I don't know if he made it intentionally as a trilogy, but it's kind of marketed as such, you know. The Wrong Move and Kings of the Road are the other two.
Yeah, I think it works well as a trilogy, but yeah, I love Alice in the Cities as well, and I love how that Alice in the Cities evolved into Paris, Texas, certain plot elements. Actually, I think it's almost an amalgam of Paris, Texas mm-hmm. and Kings of the Road in a way, so yeah, and... So he basically just took his two greatest hits and made them into his greatest hit.
My dream is to get, you know, both. I would love to get Wim Wenders on my podcast, which I've been trying to do, you know, every time he comes through and mm-hmm. not success, obviously. And then also the actor, Rutger Vogler, who is...
Rutger Vogler?
Rutger?
Yeah,
okay.
he'd be terrific. And Yeah.
Have you seen him in any like screening or is he on some sort of more contemporary, maybe bonus content on Filmstruck?
I think he has been on the discs. I could be wrong. I believe he's working still, but obviously he's not. He was a strapping lad in Alice in the Cities.
But I just loved his performances in those movies because it was just he had no fear, and you know he's obviously it was just this incredible pairing. Not many people talk about it, but it's like, you know, he was obviously, there's many cases of filmmakers and actors, and we're more familiar with, let's say, Scorsese's relationship with De Niro or with Harvey Keitel or someone like that, whereas Wim Wenders and Rutger had that same kind of, relationship. But it's just so powerful through those three films.
And I think his face just fits so well with Wenders' aesthetic. He had an expressionless face and kind of a passive face, but I think he did a lot. You know, it's kind of like you find the nuance in his expressions as you rewatch Alice in the Cities, especially as the film goes on and the story goes on, you can kind of see the evolution of his performance. So I just pulled him up, and he's 75 now. And yeah, he is still working, but doing TV. If I'm doing TV at 75, or if I'm doing anything at 75, I'll be happy.
Yeah, well, 75 is, you know, there are people well into their 80s and 90s working. So yeah. he's a healthy guy. Of course, they used to smoke like chimneys.
Yeah,
the Germans, they invented that. You know, I mean, it's.
And Agnes Varda is she's in her 80s. I know you had her on your podcast, right? And she's getting an Oscar this year, maybe two.
Maybe two, because she may get the best documentary. That's right. It was a case where I rarely do this, but it was a round table. But, you know, it's like, because, you know, a podcast, if you do an interview format, you can't do it at a round table, which is for those listening who don't know, you know, at a press junket or whatever, they'll have one thing they do is they'll put a bunch of journalists at a table with the whomever, the actors or the filmmakers or both, and you can ask questions. And most people are recording it for transcribing or whatever, you know. And so, but for a podcast, it makes absolutely no sense. So, but in this case, there were like two other people, and they were both very quiet. And I just said, let me see if I can do this. And I put my mic in front of them, and I asked a few questions, and I edited it together. And I just said, you know, there's no way I'm not putting this in my podcast. But it was a little bit, a very rare exception to the, you know, more conventional interview that I do.
That's very, very cool. I think the world of Agnes Varda.
Oh my God,
she's tremendous, and I love just her that she didn't show up for the Oscar picture, but they put the cardboard cutout of her. Did you see that? It's great. So okay, well,
which makes complete sense in terms of also the film that you know she and JR did to have a cutout of her makes it's a perfect. Poetically speaking.
And I have not seen that yet. That's one of the big omissions in my Oscar viewing. So would you like to talk about Silence of the Lambs, or would you like to take a break first?
Certainly not.
Yeah, this is one of those films that I think it's pretty safe. We don't have to really worry about spoilers because I think just about everybody in our audience or who's been into film for the last couple of decades or a few decades, 3 decades, I guess, has seen it. But I also saw it in the theaters, and I was a youngster. You asked my age. I graduated high school in 1990, so I was just out of high school when this came out.
Okay, so I'm not like, you know, generation.
We're pretty close.
It makes me about 8 or 9 years older.
Okay. So, but you can probably imagine going to see this film, and I remember distinctly going. And it's not like I have memories of going to movie theaters, each individual experience, but this one I do. I went with friends and we were in a sort of van, not like a VW van, but like a minivan of some sort. But somebody, I think like a friend was driving. And we were thinking about what to see. And they thought, okay, let's see a horror film. And of course, we just gotten out of the 80s, so we saw a lot of horror films. And they're like, oh, yeah, The Silence of the Lambs. I remember being so affected by this in 1991. Now, of course, this is very early on in my cinephilia. I'm not going to credit this for my taste in cinema. I think those seeds that have already been planted. And I wouldn't call this the greatest thriller of all time, but I do remember in 1991, it was more shocking then or more more disturbing then than it is now. And I don't think I can look at this film objectively in 2018, I've seen it probably 20 times. And it's not that I just love the film and I just seek it out. In fact, it's been probably a good decade easy since I've seen it, but it's just, you can't avoid it. So did you get a chance to rewatch it?
Oh, yeah. I watched it as soon as I got it. Yeah, I couldn't wait to see it again. And I probably had seen it, I haven't seen it 20 times, but I've seen it at least half a dozen times. And I, most recently, not that long ago, but it just doesn't matter once you put it on. It's among an elite group of films like that, wherever you put it on, if you're, let's say, just surfing through, you know, cable or whatever, wherever you land, you're going to watch from that point right to the end. It's one of those kinds of films.
Absolutely.
And I don't know about 20 times in or however many times you've seen it, but if you aren't picking up more information each time, I'm surprised. Like, there's just so much information, and you just can pick up another, you know, detail that you never quite captured before. It's another thing, that a phenomenon about silence.
And you know, there's a tipping point, and I say 20 times. It's more of an expression. I've probably seen bits and pieces of it 20 times. I've certainly seen the fava beans line 20 times, probably 20,000 times. But
including that with every set, satirical, or parody rather, not satirical.
Right. You know, Simpsons or whatever. I'm sure there's been plenty. But it's almost, I think I've seen it so many times that there's less in the frame for me to see. Does that make sense? It's just, it can only reveal so much. This is not 8.5 where you can watch that 30 times and probably get something out of it. Or even Avengers, Wings of Desire, I think you could probably watch that a number of times and get a Persona for sure. I think I have seen that one several times. But I think this is groundbreaking as far as procedurals go, and especially forensic. Sure. I don't think we had those CSI shows back then. So I guess, just to be frank, do you still like this film? Do you think it holds up?
I do. I mean, it feels a little like Anthony Hopkins' performance feels a little bit more broad now. It just feels a little bit, you know, like, whereas kind of terrifying. But it just might be because he, you know, up to that point, even though he was a big star in the UK, and even here he was already a notable, you know, he was like a protege of Laurence Olivier, and, you know, he has a big theater background. But here he wasn't a big star until then. Then he was like catapulted into the Hollywood stratosphere. I think he's, you know, done very well, obviously, financially for himself. But he squandered a
good
great
career.
Deal. I think he squandered a bit of it on a lot of garbage movies, frankly, but not all. But,
I agree.
So now, it doesn't quite hold up in that same way. And some of the jokes seem a little bit... you look at it at it a little differently.
Yeah, they don't land as well. And I think you're right, because we see Anthony Hopkins, and of course we see all the period pieces and all the bad movies he's been in. And actually, by then he was groundbreaking, and he was this new face, and he was thrilling. But now he kind of seems a little hammy. And I'm not knocking it. I think it's a good performance, but also the way they accentuate it, you know, all the extreme close-ups, it's like, okay, all right, we got it. Yeah. I'm not knocking it at all. I think
I also wonder, And I wonder also if up to that time, just how many, at the time that was felt very, very gritty. Whereas now, you know, after, let's say, a movie like Seven, which I think came out.
Yeah.
What's the timeline?
I think just a few years from there. But that's also a great example. It's also very gritty, and it's not really glamorous, kind of.
Right. I think we, you know, our you know, the bar has just kept rising in terms of what feels more and more realistic, and so I don't know, now it feels a little bit, it's just kind of like more like, feels like a studio picture, and
it does.
So that's something I can criticize. But I still feel like, what a great director Jonathan Demme is, and I also love doing this. If there are two actors that are in the film that have done my podcast.
Oh, really? Both Hopkins
two people in that film and they're not part of the main cast, but there's two people in the film who have done my show.
Oh, well, you have to share.
Yeah, well, I want to make sure I get their names right, too, because if you go back, so I'm looking through the booklet that came with the, here it is. Okay, Pilcher, who was working in, I think, one of the coroners, one of the bodies,
okay,
was brought in. Pilcher, played by the actor Paul Lazar.
Okay.
Paul Lazar is a friend going back. When I first started even at Bebox, he was an actor. He's always popped up in most Jonathan Demme films in some role or other, some supporting role. And the other is actually Roger Corman.
Oh, really? He acted in the film?
Yeah, he has a role in the film. He plays
FBI
director Hayden Burke.
That's right. I forgot about that. Yeah.
It's a cameo, for sure, if you can call a cameo an acting role. But he's very good in it. He's only in it for a moment. But, you know, is Jonathan Demme, who started working for Corman. So
I have not seen his Corman movies, but I think I kind of know what to expect. The corner scene was remarkable. That's one thing. I think it is definitely an entertaining film. And you mentioned it. It does feel like a mainstream film. I noticed I read one article about it. They called it an art thriller. And I don't know if I would go that far.
Was that an article, like a contemporary article, or is that like an old article?
It was a contemporary, yeah. It was a reflection on it. But at the time, I think we thought of it. I mean, it was a February release. It came out on Valentine's Day, which I think is kind of fitting with the Criterion release.
It's a love story, you know. I mean, in a way, you know, Clarice Starling, right? Hannibal Lecter, there is a love story there.
There is some. I don't want to say sexual politics, but definitely some gender politics. And actually, that's a good some good transition. I think now we're in the height of the Me Too movement, and there's a big feminine wave with in film. Female directors are getting opportunities, and I think that's great. I think it's about time. But and also female actors. I guess it is female actors. That's the appropriate thing. I think like the SAG, the SAG version.
Yeah.
But I think back in 1991, and I'm sure there are plenty of exceptions, but I don't know that we've had quite as empowering and a character that we had in Clarice Starling. You know, she's kind of unassuming, and she takes a lot from the men, the boys' club that's basically running the show, the FBI, or, you know, FBI is a very masculine enterprise, any sort of police, forensic, detective. And I think that's what actually struck me now, and maybe I'm looking for it just because of the time we're in. But I think actually I was more impressed with Foster now than I was Hopkins, just because I thought hers was more subtle, and maybe that just is my taste, is I go for more of the subtleties and expressing yourself, and I think she actually does speak for women in difficult roles, different professional roles, and living in a man's world in that film. And there's the one scene where she calls out the police for the officer for making mention of her being a lady, and I was surprised at how much empowering there is.
Yeah, there's that elevator scene. There's this where she gets in the at the very beginning where she gets in the elevator during the opening montage. People may or may not recall the opening montage is really her, Jodie Foster, in training at Quantico. And there's a scene where, you know, she gets on the elevator with a bunch of her trainee colleagues. And, you know, she's this very petite woman in the elevator with these strapping guys. And then there's that scene, of course, where, you know, at the funeral, where she's, you know, in the next room with a bunch of local deputies, and she asks them all to kind of take off. It's almost like a direct nod between that, the direct relationship between that character in that environment and her as an actor also in that time as well. And even, as you pointed out, until more recently, but Jodie Foster was a powerhouse, you know, actor. And
absolutely.
Way before the Me Too, wave. I mean, I shouldn't use that term because it's sort of suggesting it's kind of temporary. But
right, I think you're right. It's not maybe not a wave, but it's a transition. Yeah.
It's a transitional time, but she was a forerunner, and you know, maybe before her in terms of the last 30, 40 years since, you know, women's lib and feminism was a thing. Barbara Streisand, maybe. I mean, can you think of anybody else in the movie industry who was like that, had that kind of power? Or Jodie Foster?
Well,
did.
Streep, I guess, but I think of Streep as doing great characters, but not strong. You're right. Foster has done a lot of. She started with the Bad News Bears for, you know, so she's her whole career is strong characters. Now, like Hopkins, she hasn't always made the best choices.
Oh, Jodie Foster?
Yeah, well, like Flight Plan and some of her Hollywood films. But she's
she's done it all. I mean, she's a director, producer, and actor, and that's kind of more what I was talking about in a man's world, where I don't think there was too many Jodie Fosters and Barbara Streisands who were, you know, kind of doing everything, you know, and were getting the kinds of probably salaries that, you know, were much higher than most other.
I have the utmost respect for her as an actress and a human being, but I don't think she's working a whole lot now, and I don't know if that's by choice or, I think this is definitely among her crowning achievements. She's had quite a career. So anyway, we usually don't spend a lot of time. It's easy to talk about this film. Oh, I just want to say that the ending is still thrilling. And I thought that the gender politics with the villain and. Just in case anybody hasn't seen it, I won't get into the ending. But I thought that would bother me a little more now because of where we are. And not as much. And I don't know.
I agree with you.
I think it was more rooted in the character, I think. But that said, it's still portraying a transgender, transgender.
Using contemporary parlance, I agree. Yeah, you would probably call her... Maybe
right.
Now we refer to Buffalo Bill as a her.
Right. Back then they would not. Where we've changed.
And, yeah, you know what? Movies like, handling just like them like freaks. And it's interesting because, you know, you're still the one character is a serial killer, you know, but mm-hmm. you know, who's a transgender. But anyway, but I think they still did it rather sensitively as on some level.
Yeah, as much as you could in 1991, I think. I think people take exception to them having a transgender serial killer. I was actually curious and just if there had been others before, and there had been. And of course, it was in the books from Thomas Harris. He'd written throughout the 80s, and the 80s had a different perspective, and you and I probably remember sexuality was a little different in that time. Well, anyway, let's move on from Silence of the Lambs. I think we're in agreement that it's worthwhile. I do like you mentioned the booklet. It is a very great package. You know, the Inkblot mm-hmm. cover. I think it's a nice one to have on the shelf. I don't know if I'm going to watch it 20 more times, but I will definitely watch it again. So we have a segment we call Short Takes, where we talk about just any criterion we've seen recently. And I know you've had a couple, so would you like to share any films you've seen?
Well, would Midnight Cowboy be there since they're releasing that?
Fair game, yeah.
I mean,
it's a pretty loose definition. It's really just anything that's criterion related.
Well, if you're a Criterion fan and you don't have a copy, get when the Midnight Cowboy, that's about to come out.
It comes out in May. It was just announced, I think, a couple weeks ago.
Okay, yeah. I mean, I just watched it, but I'm just going to, if I don't get my copy, as I said before, sometimes I get copies through mm-hmm. the press people there. But if I don't, I'm definitely going to pay for that. I cannot wait for a copy of that. That's got to be one of my favorite films of all time. And it's just it's such an incredible snapshot of New York, and just two unbelievable portraits, performances.
Yeah.
But between Dustin Hoffman and John Voight. And I think when I watched the other day, the John Voight all of a sudden had his performance all of a sudden, for whatever reason, it really was, I found it especially gripping, you know?
Yeah, and he's actually, we talked about Jodie Foster, and we could say the same about Hoffman. They've had great careers, and Voight's had his high points, but you don't really see him as see the actor as a titan these days. In fact, I think politically he's probably hurt himself a little bit. I think.
But then again, they're controversial. And Ray Donovan is also, I think, maybe leveled that out a bit because
is
he's
that good?
Got. Oh yeah, it's okay. A great show. I mean, it's kind of like Sopranos, the formula of it, but it's probably should have ended by now, but it's been on for a bunch of seasons. Maybe it's in its fourth year or fifth year. I'm not even sure. But I watched the first few seasons and it was great. And one of the main reasons, truthfully, why it's a great show is because of just John Voight's performance is just amazing. And he's in his 80s, I think. You know, but he's or late 70s. But he's as good as he's ever been as an actor. You know, it's just been a great vehicle for him.
I thought he won an Oscar. Was that for? That wasn't for this, was it?
For Midnight Cowboy?
No, I don't think so. Was it?
For
Ray Donovan or something?
Ray Donovan. What?
Was it the Champ?
Oh, geez, that would have been
Have been the Champ.
He did the train, the Runaway Train, which got great reviews. He might have gotten. If we could cheat, I'd be happy.
I cheated. He got one for Coming Home, which I haven't. That's Ashby, right? I haven't seen that. That's a big omission in my 70s viewing.
Yeah, well, I'm almost happy for you because it gives you something to look forward to. I mean, you know, never seen it, and it's one of the, you know, I mean, it's kind of polemical a little bit, but it's, you know, it wears its emotion on its sleeve. You know, it's a bit very, very, I don't know what the word is, sentimental, but it's still a very beautiful performance by Voight, and everybody in it is great. You know, Fondette or Beth.
I think I tend to avoid sentimentality, so that might be why I haven't watched it. But I should trust in Ashby. I think his body of work in the 70s is pretty strong.
Yeah, but it's not like it's kind of conventional for. I might be short selling it, but it's a little bit for I'd say for Hal Ashby, it's a bit conventional.
Okay. Oh,
it's still worth, what? Still definitely worth your seeing, and I think it should definitely be on the Criterion Collection. I mean, I think almost anything Ashby has directed should be.
Yeah, he was pretty radical. I think for this, even for the American New Wave, I just think Harold and Maude is terrific, but not a lot of films like Harold and Maude even in that time. Well, mine is The Hero, which is a recent release from Satyajit Ray, and it's actually the latest Ray that. That has been made it to the collection, and I think it was 1966, and I don't have my stuff open, so forgive me if I can't remember all the names, but have you seen much Ray? Apu, maybe?
Apu trilogy, yeah.
Yeah.
Which is just beautiful.
It is beautiful. This was, I've seen probably maybe not quite a dozen, but maybe less than 10 Ray films, and every one of them has been remarkable. And this is right up there with it, with his filmography. And it's one of those introspective. It's a celebrity. It's an actor who's on a train. He's actually played by, and that's what I was trying to look up. I forget the name of the actor. It is Uttam Kumar, who shamefully I've never seen any of his films, but I think he was basically a mainstream Indian film star, but one of the biggest film stars from India. I think he's seen as a legend and was seen. So he's basically playing a variation of himself, although I think he's still playing a character, and he's playing it. So I think it borrows a lot from 8 and a half, and I haven't had a chance to read much, maybe a little bit of La Dolce Vita. Contempt, maybe, but it's an actor who is questioning his, I guess, the idea of celebrity, questioning, I guess, the
midlife crisis involved in that at all, or
little bit, but it's more just the commerciality versus the art, and and also just where he's at in life. It's a great performance. It's actually very daring for him at that time, because this is a actor who was at the top of his game, and he's playing a guy has some flaws, and probably for his brand, that's probably not part of him that he'd want to reveal. And I don't think that was part of him. I think he was playing a part, but it's such a great performance. And from what I understand about it, the rest of his work, I don't think it's really equaled anywhere. And so I was really taken by this film. Just like I think Ray has one of the highest batting averages for me. Maybe just his style works for me. But if you haven't seen The Hero I would definitely recommend it. It's a little thin on the supplements, and I haven't watched any yet, but it was a very strong film. I think it came out just after Charolata. Have you seen that one?
No, you know, I'm so grateful for this conversation because you're learning me. You're schooling.
I'm schooling you. Well, he's a somebody that I would love to teach. He's a very great filmmaker. And he does a lot of, this is actually kind of unusual territory for him. He does a lot of Indian stories. He's a Bengali director. And Apu, for sure, is very much India reconciling its place in the world. Charolata, the Music Room, there are many others. This one, I think, is different because it looks at celebrity, and it doesn't really look at cultural India. And
It's a meta movie for him.
It is very, yeah. And I'm sure I haven't seen everything he's done. I think he's done like 50 pictures. I'm sure there's some parallels there. But anyway,
you said 60s, this one?
66, I believe.
So it was in the thrust of really the new wave, the French New Wave, and...
And he was influenced by all of that, and we sure. did a lot of talking about Renoir, and you know Renoir filmed The River there, and so he was influenced by that, and he was more of an international director. In fact, he was celebrated more internationally than he was in his home country. So, I think it was probably targeted more towards people in Europe and America, the West, than it was at home. But anyway, I really love his work. So, well. We have Filmstruck, and there's a lot to cover, so I think I'm just going to kind of selectively make some choices here. So one thing they do on the main channel, they have Directors of the Week, and so I think I'm just going to edit away some of the content. There's just too much to talk about. So there are two Directors of the Week of the last 2 weeks. There was Peter Greenaway and Fred Zinnemann. So Greenaway is... British, and Zinnemann is classic Hollywood.
By way of, you know, Eastern Europe.
Oh, actually, no, he's there. He's also British, isn't he?
No, he's the Eastern European. He escaped the Holocaust, I think.
Okay.
I believe he's one of the kind of those emigres who left, fled fascist Europe on the heels of, you know, just escaping his what would have probably been his demise if he escaped.
Maybe it's because, yeah, I guess the name Zinnemann is not very Anglo, but I guess thinking of A Man for All Seasons, which is his, that's his, probably his high point, most successful, I think, most decorated. Have you seen many of his films?
Yeah, I've seen a bunch, and I'm just going to be a little bit more prepared. I should have, Fred Zinnemann was, he was definitely born in Austria and he definitely escaped, Nazi Germany, although he's born in Poland. So there's, cause I just read this big, biography about Billy Wilder and he was mentioned in there too.
Which biography?
Oh, it's by this guy, Ed Sykov.
It's great.
I just did the show and I'm going to post that episode shortly. A little plug for my podcast. Again.
Awesome. Yeah, but, I'll enjoy
I really enjoyed that book, and he includes an afterword where he talks about having written the book and then having lunch with Billy Wilder, I guess just a few years before he died.
And, you know, this is a little digression, but when I was watching The Hero, I remembered something from Billy Wilder. And so this is a big digression because there's an interaction with an older actor who is – traditionally out of fashion, but I think had the more art. You know, he was a seasoned actor, did things his way. So there was Billy Wilder was having lunch with Louis Mayer, and this guy. Have you heard this story? I think it was in this book.
Okay.
He's having lunch with Louis Mayer, and in walks this guy who looks like he's homeless, and he basically just says, "You guys are ruining the film industry. Your work is crap," and. Gets thrown out of the restaurant, and then Wilder is stunned and says, "Who was that guy?" And Louis Mayer looks at him and says, "You didn't recognize him? That was D.W. Griffith, one of the greatest working directors of all time." Of course, also controversial, but it is, you know, that was in the 50s, and so it's
Yeah, I do recall that now that you mentioned it. I forgot about it, you know.
Anyway, so Fred Zinnemann.
I look at High Noon, another subject of another book I recently read and had the author on my show, High Noon, which was made during the thrust of the Red Scare here in America in the 50s. But High Noon, Fred Zinnemann directed, as well as From Here to Eternity, which is big, big successful film, as well as A Man for All Seasons, which you mentioned.
Speaking of, I guess, Red Connection, he also did the movie Redis, and I was not doing wordplay. I was talking about it's a very, I wouldn't say communistic theme, maybe socialist theme, about a fishing town, and it was from the 30s. He co-directed that with somebody else, I forget who. But yeah, Zinnemann's quite a body of work. Kind of a mixed bag. It's weird seeing A Man for All Seasons as one of his final films. It gets a little hated on. I actually think it's a tremendous film, and I really like the performance. And I can't think of the actor off the top of my head that played Schofield, was it?
Yeah, Paul Schofield.
Yeah, so
British
Thomas More.
Yeah, and known for also his theater background. But pretty successful film actor as well for a while there.
And I think he won the Oscar for that. And we're about to watch Oscars. And then, do you know Peter Greenaway very well? He's more of a
Another big movie for me as a young guy discovering was The Cook. The thief, his wife, her lover.
Oh yeah,
and like then it was around that time that probably not. I don't remember the exact timeline, but probably not that far from when Wim Wenders' Rings of Desire came out, and that same kind of period for me where I was just discovering all these great filmmakers on my own, these international filmmakers or world cinema, and just blew me away. It was very hard to watch, and I came out very upset by it because it was really disturbing film, but I came out of there changed, and I said, got to respect that. I'm a different person than I was when I walked in, and that's what you're going into the movies for, supposedly. I mean, at least that used to be the case. I don't think it is anymore, but and then again, never quite repeated in any subsequent films, and I've seen a few others after that, and I went back and I watched a couple of his early films, like The Belly of an Architect and
Zed and Two Knots. He's had a few, but I think Zed and Two Knots is a big one of his.
Okay, I have not seen that one.
Yeah.
I should go see that. Yeah.
He doesn't have a lot available in the States, I don't think right. Digitally, because he's a very, very English director. But yeah, The Cook, The Thief.
And he's an art filmmaker. He's an experimentalist. I mean, he's not.
Much.
He's definitely not somebody who ever really was a mainstream. And the fact that, that movie hit big, and it's more about distribution at this particular time, honestly, than anything else. And that, they just were able to successfully market The Cook, The Thief.
That's kind of on the heels of the sort of the end of right before the American indie movement, I think. You were seeing a lot of foreign edgy films. Yeah, he definitely is very compromising.
There were just these art house independent film distributors that were boutique distributors at the time. They were considered boutique,
right.
And all majors had, these smaller subdivisions. And they were really, like Fine Line, and they were all releasing these, great art films, and so it was just an incredible time to be living in New York and all these great movies coming out from all these great directors, and I would say right at the top there was Peter Greenaway and The Cook, The Thief.
I wish I was there, boy. It sounds great. I did not see The Cook, The Thief until about a year or two ago.
That's how I discovered so many great. I mean, that's how I saw was introduced to Mike Lee.
Mm-hmm.
Spears, and with My Beautiful Laundrette, and I mean, just so many fantastic films were coming out in that time.
Yeah, that was when Mike Lee was really getting going with Life is Sweet, and then Naked would come up soon. So, let me just kind of run through the Criterion Channel stuff. No, you're good.
Don't get me started.
That's the thing I love about the show. We go and we just go where the show takes us. So I'm gonna skip the shortened features and double features. they're fine, but I'll just talk about the digital spines. So Digital Spine 909 is Night of the Living Dead. So that actually I just received that. That's the Romero. And I'm going to save that actually for October.
Romero, by the way, I'm sorry to interrupt you because I'm a big mouth and I Which, such. But Romero also has a cameo in Silence of the Lambs to bring this around full circle.
Oh, wow. I missed that.
Yeah, it's not even a spoken word part. It's just this little thing where I think he's like one of the cops in, the scene where he, you know, he's in that, like, at the last where he escapes.
Right.
Essentially,
right
before he escapes, there's a scene with a couple of extra cops that come in, or it was maybe right after he escapes. And one of the, I think he's just one of the cops in the room is George Romero.
Basically an extra. I had no idea. That's
yeah, he's an extra. Or it might have been like one of the you know, medical or whatever they call mm-hmm. them, that take, you know, take away the cops.
The EMTs or something?
Yeah, exactly. Somewhere in there is George Romero. Go ahead.
There is a commentary on the disc. So I in fact, it's an older commentary. I thought about watching it. It's probably from the Criterion Laserdisc.
Yeah, I was going to talk about this originally, except that we've talked about so much else, but I won't make a big deal out of it. It's not like the audio commentary, like a typical one you might hear where they're kind of sitting around and they're talking about the movie as it happens. It's almost spliced together recollections by all the major people in the film. So it's Jonathan Demme and it's, Anthony Hopkins and Jodie Foster, but it feels like they're just recalling anecdotes or, you know, memories from making the film, but it's not a proper. So it may be a disappointment to some people, but others will probably appreciate it.
So it might work as a podcast then. So if you want to put your DVD in, although I know a lot of people actually will rip the commentaries and listen to them like podcasts, it probably would work well. I haven't heard it, but. And then we had In the Mood for Love, Wong Kar-wai. We also had Francis Ha, and I'm sure that's very New York. French-inspired New York film.
And I've had both Wong Kar-wai and Noah Baumbach on my show. So.
Wow. That's awesome. So what were they like? I could talk to you all day about this stuff.
I know. I should have done a two-parter.
You can't get two different types of people either. Baumbach and Wong Kar-wai. You can't really compare those two. Well, you haven't had Murray Lerner, have you?
What?
Murray, the next one is Festival by Lerner. Oh. So,
no.
Anyway, sorry, I interrupted you. Wong Kar-wai and Baumbach.
they couldn't be more different. Wong Kar-wai wore dark glasses. Noah Baumbach didn't. That's reductive.
I think somebody I know knows Baumbach and said he's one of the or has seen him in person and said he's one of the best looking people he's ever seen. It's not fair that he gets to be a movie director.
Oh, I wouldn't have had that. Was that a male or a female?
It was a male. I think it was maybe like his attire or something. Maybe just.
Oh yeah, he's put together. Yeah, and he's good. Got great hair, and he's got small features, so he looks great. I guess on camera too, but I went in the next room and talked to Greta Gerwig. So it was a good experience.
Big year for her. Maybe big week for her. We'll see next week. And I'm just going to skip the rest. The only one thing I'll mention is they have a late Buñuel films. There are four films, and I forget which ones they are. I'm going to look it up real quick. Forgive me. It is This Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie, The Milky Way, That Obscure Object of Desire, and The Phantom of Liberty. So that's mid to the early 70s, so that's probably before you cut your teeth on film. Have you seen any of these?
Was this the Buñuel, is that what you're saying?
Louis Buñuel.
I've seen a lot of his, most well known, but I discovered them definitely as a mature person, you know. I remember the titles very well from growing up, but because they were so famous. Mm-hmm. Diary of a Chambermaid or whatever but I saw them all as like somebody probably in their 30s and 40s or something.
Yeah, like us, right? Like us, so like me right now. So I haven't seen the Milky Way. I've seen the rest, and they're all. Speaking of Ray and batting averages, he has a pretty high batting average too. Didn't make a lot of films. Definitely not as many as Ray. I didn't really mean to compare the two, but I think actually people have trouble with The Phantom of Liberty, I think, just because it's just more awkward. It's more episodic. Mm-hmm. So anyway, well, that's the episode. So do you have, we do this thing called Piece of Flair, where we just talk about something that's not Criterion related. Do you have anything? I'm sure you have something film related.
Oh, I just want to mention that we have an upcoming, for your listeners might be of interest then, if they are looking at my show, is I'm going to be doing this Paul Schrader kind of round table, which is definitely borrowing from the Wrong Reel type of approach. But in fact, the James Hancock, who is, you know, the host of Wrong Reel, is going to be one of the panelists.
Oh, really? Excuse me.
It's going to be, there's a few of us. I mentioned Jeremy Workman to you, who's a filmmaker. He's got a new documentary at South by Southwest coming up next month. And then also James Hernandez Rosenblatt, also known as Chico Leo, who's another like cinephile, who's going to be on this little roundtable we're doing. And we're going to talk about the career of Paul Schrader. And so for me, it's like planting a seed. So I'm going to be essentially doing the show. And then kind of when I do approach his publicist with the new film, First Reformed, that's coming out soon, I can say, well, we just did this, tribute to him, and so now you should put him on my podcast.
You should, yeah, and put him on mine too, if you don't mind. Actually, our good friend David Blakeslee lives in Grand Rapids, and just saw him at a festival. Of course, Schrader has—that's where they went to college together. Didn't know each other, but they went to college together, which I think is pretty cool. But Schrader, I think David might be trying to get him on our podcast too. So we'll have to see how our chances go. I'm not holding my breath, but
I hope you do.
Yeah, he's such a great voice on film, and Mishima is coming out on the Criterion Collection in May, the upgrade. So, yeah, I he has so many great stories. I've listened to a couple of his commentaries, audio commentaries on discs, and you mentioned Hardcore recently, but Blue Collar is a tremendous film. I think that's one of his overlooked gems, and of course he's written
feature that he directed.
Yeah, that is. Yeah, very. And you know, speaking of, you mentioned George C. Scott. He had a tendency to work with difficult actors, and I think Richard Pryor was one of the most difficult people he ever worked with, but boy, that performance works. And same with Scott in Hardcore. I know Hardcore is not as celebrated, but I think it's a fine film.
Oh, it's definitely one. It's an entertaining. You got to watch it. You got to see Hardcore.
Yeah. Well, and speaking of old New York, you know, even though that was San Diego, it definitely captures that world that may not exist too much, at least not in that version anymore. Well, my piece of flair is that I've been catching up on, I guess you'd say, Oscar films. So I'll spoil it for our Patreon listeners. We're going to do a bonus episode on Oscars this week. So I've been watching. Trying to pull up my notes.
Icarus.
Icarus was one. I think that's a good shot of winning the documentary feature. I'm rooting for Agnes Varda, even though I haven't seen it, just because I just love her. But Icarus was actually quite an impressive movie, and very timely with the Olympics going on and all the Russian doping scandals.
Yeah. So it's very important. Really important. It's possibly of all the contenders for best documentary. I think it's got to be considered the most important film.
And it's in a different way too. I was quite taken with this film, and this is revealing a little bit about me. But what's interesting is that I used to be very athletic, and I got injured, and I used to ride a bike. And the guy who made the film, the way he stumbled onto this doping scandal, was training for an event. Was actually using drugs to train for an event that I was actually training for. And in fact, it might have been the same year. I forget. It's been a few years now. I didn't end up going because I got hurt. But I just thought it was very strange how small the world is. I did not do any steroids or any
performance
enhancing. No, I use performance enhancing drugs for the podcast. It's coffee. And
I was wondering what your secret was.
That's it. But yeah, I was actually very taken. It was a very riveting watch, and just the way the story. And that's one thing with documentary film is it's a lot of times you just get lucky with the subject. And so he meant to make one film about his own exploits into performance enhancing drugs. And if he'd made it, it probably would have been good, but not as revelatory. And he stumbled upon the guy who broke open the entire doping scandal for Russia and got them kicked out of the Olympics. And of course, they had two athletes test positive last week, so it still lives and breathes. I've also been catching up on others. I watched Blade Runner 2049. I watched Three Billboards, and yeah, didn't care as much for Three Billboards.
Really?
Do you have any favorites in the Oscar season?
Well, I, Tanya.
I haven't seen that yet. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Speaking of Olympics.
And I did. I like Three, but I saw these in at screenings though. So I think, you know, it sounds like you're watching them maybe at home, or is it?
Yeah. And I did all of these at home.
Okay, I saw all of the ones you've mentioned so far in screenings, which is not always typical, by the way. But mm-hmm. These cases I did. But part of the thing is I'm also going because I think. Because usually the publicists invite me to the screening, and I go, and it increases the likelihood that I'll get somebody from the film on my podcast.
Oh, that's good thinking.
Unless they give it, or if they provide a link. But many of these, they weren't doing that. I definitely benefited from seeing all these on the big screen, I think, including Icarus. It was very cinematic.
Oh, really? Okay.
I've seen at this stage – pretty much all the again, it's something I strive for, but rarely succeed at, is seeing all the nominated, you know, nominated films. But I did this year.
Oh, good. Even so, Roman Esquire, what the Denzel film?
Yep.
Okay. Was that good?
He was phenomenal.
Really? Okay.
And he was, I don't know if the film is Oscar worthy, but it's one of the best things I've ever seen him do. He
really?
Was just so believable in this role, and he really committed to it. I have to say, it's a small film, which mm-hmm. is only big because Denzel Washington is big.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people think he took James Franco's nomination because of the controversy, which may be true.
But I think he's much more worthy of an Oscar than James Franco was. And I'm not saying James Franco wasn't fine, but I don't. I just think it was a little bit hokey.
It's an imitation.
I wasn't moved, but I was very moved by Denzel Washington.
Okay. Well, I used to go to a lot of screenings, and I used to go to a lot of press and premiere screenings and festival screenings. And I think you can easily get, and I'm not criticizing you personally, but I'm criticizing mm-hmm. myself here, but sometimes it's easy to get wrapped up in buzz, and sometimes sure. that does impact your impression. And Three Billboards is a film that, so actually my brother went to college at Western Carolina, and they filmed that right where, so when I went and visited him, that's where I was. It was Ebbings, Missouri, but it was actually Cooley and Sula, North Carolina. So that was great. I thought the movie kind of, I had some issues with it. I'm not going to go into it here, but I did have some issues. I did like McDormand. And
come on my show and talk about it.
Sure, yeah. Well, I don't want to, there are a lot of fans, and it might win next week. Between that and The Shape of Water. But well, Adam, thank you for coming on. It's a blast. So many stories. We could talk for hours, and maybe we will. But where can people find you and the show online?
Yeah, FilmWax. Start with FilmWaxRadio.com. But you can also find it, of course, if you subscribe on iTunes and leave a star rating and a review or whatever comments. It would be great help. But FilmWax Radio, you can click and find the entire archive of back episodes. And we're on Facebook and, of course, Twitter and Instagram, YouTube.
The whole shebang. Well, you can find us on the Criterion Cast Master Feed, which is, you can find us along with other shows. We have a Facebook group, which is a lot of fun. We mostly talking about pee breaks these days. I'm on Twitter, AWES505, although I don't tweet a whole lot. Of course, support us. Our Patreon campaign is patreon.com/criterionnow. And again, thank you for everybody that supported us. You're going to reap some rewards soon, not only physical in your mailbox, but also hopefully digital in your device. Thanks, Adam.
Thank you very much. It's been so much fun.